All right, this being the last Shabbat before Yom Kippur, the normal Torah cycle would include a special reading, and that's where we're going to go and talk about a few things this week. Just so you know, that'll end up being a couple places, but primarily, traditionally, it's Leviticus chapter 16, which talks about Yom Kippur, and also the Azazel, the two goats, and some of the things that surround that. We'll go through some of that in some detail. It's always kind of been a fascinating study, I think. However, given some of the other things that are going on, given the times and the seasons, it seemed really apropos to me tonight to say, you know, that teaching actually seems to fit a lot better if we talk about some of the things going on in the news first. Simply because, of course, the idea of the day of covering or atonement, Yom HaKippurim, remember the idea of Kippurim, it's plural, of course. The head covering is called a kippah in a lot of places. There is something about this day that it resonates, I think, with the stuff that we see going on around us. And again, that's why I wanted to do some of the news first. And I actually was thinking about this. It occurred to me as we were sitting down to dinner this evening and praying, and I look out at the world, and I've been kind of increasingly blunt as far as what's been going on, I think, and how it's no longer possible, I am convinced, to look at the things going on in the world and not to recognize that this world does, in fact, belong to the adversary by default. In other words, for a long, long time, men, literally since Genesis chapter 3, have given it over to him. And when you look at the princes of the world now and see what's going on, it's, I think, worse. Certainly it's worse than it's ever been in my lifetime. It's arguably worse than it may have been in modern history, or arguably even perhaps ever in history. Evil literally just seems to be running amok. So there's a dramatic contrast at this time of the year between this idea of evil, and I'll probably even talk a little bit about some of the traditions associated with the adversary, Ha-Satan. That's kind of fascinating, I think, some of the differences between the, if you will, traditional Jewish or rabbinic teaching and the traditional potentate popish teachings about the little guy in the red suit with the horns and he pokes at people who don't like Easter eggs, I guess. But the other comment that has to do with this time of year is this concept, too, that the twin concepts of mercy and justice. We'll see all of those themes coming up. So let's start with some of the things going on in the news. Now, probably the biggest story of the week, and I suspect everybody has heard this. I will talk about it a bit because there's probably a lot that's not been talked about much. But give me some ones if you have heard the fact that, yes, Ebola has come to America with a K. Two is if you haven't heard that, there was an official case. The Ebola card has been played, I guess is one way to say it, of a man in Dallas that has officially been said to have Ebola. So are there any... okay, we got all ones. I didn't think there'd be any twos, but it's always a possibility. I've already talked to a couple people today that had not heard. Okay, so far all ones. So let's come back to that and talk about the fact that, remember, the love of money, we're reminded, is the root of all evil. Follow the money, old saying. You want to recognize what's going on. Greed, avarice, lust, a lot of those things still pretty well tell the story. And I have been suggesting for a long time that when the fiat dollar collapses and when the world economic system comes down, that it is that time when you will see World War III and so many other things literally all hit so fast that it'll be hard to tell which one's the cart and which one is the horse. And in particular, now it looks like we've got the perfect storm setting up. Looks like, given that the human heart is desperately wicked, that people have literally planned so that the Ebola thing comes down about the same time as World War III comes down, about the same time as the stock market collapse and the dollar collapse, and all of that stuff comes down. And wouldn't be surprised, too, if we saw some other things like, power grid failures come to mind, other ATM failures, you name it. Lots and lots of ugliness, almost all coming at one great big climax. And then there was this. So where I'm going to start with some of these news stories, I'll go through some of them pretty quickly here, so stay with me, has to do with the fact that if you look at the economics of the situation, you can really kind of see what the milestones along the road are. Here's a story that came out earlier about Goldman Sachs. There was a woman who came up with, I think it was 42 hours worth of tapes. This is a supposed regulator sitting in these meetings with Goldman Sachs, who they were supposedly regulating. And basically, she was shocked, I tell you, to find out that they were all in bed together. One hand washes the other, and that there were a lot of big clients and big people that were above the law. Imagine that. And so if you hadn't heard that story, I won't belabor it. It's kind of like the latest version of the famous Nixon tapes from decades ago. And the more comes out about it, the more people are saying, well, this is kind of surprising. Well, no, it's not. We've already known it. It's inevitable because the human heart is desperately wicked. When you put regulators in a position of saying, well, the people that I regulate are the ones that I deal with all the time, and guess what? Cross my palm with silver. I want a job after I'm done with this position in government, getting paid on the public teat. Who better to work with than the people that I've established this great rapport by ignoring the law? And then you got Congress critters wonder why it is that the regulators and the regulatees seem to be colluding together. Imagine all of that. Anyway, there's a piece here. I'll just do the headline from David Stockman, former Reagan-era budget director. The Goldman tapes and why this delusion about what he calls MACPRU, macroprudential regulation, and the fact that it's a ruse, it's a farce, and now it's all been revealed, means the time for the next crash is literally at hand. Yeah, surprise, surprise. He goes through the details and the numbers, but it really does just boil down to follow the money. The love of money is the root of all evil, and the human heart is desperately wicked. Who can know it? Here's another piece from Richard Russell, kind of the old man in the sea, as I refer to him, of financial newsletters. Guy's got a tremendous reputation, and he's been writing newsletters for well over half a century. I think it's probably 60 years at this point. And he talks about this week the financial meltdown, which is now nigh at hand, and calls it a once-in-600-year event. Remember a 100-year flood or a 500-year flood? Well, according to Russell, this coming meltdown is a 600-year flood. And ultimately, he says, there'll only be two survivors for sure. That's silver and gold. And when you look at all the details, maybe it doesn't come as a surprise at all. Here's another case in point. Now, again, we're starting with economics because follow the money. Remember, like the men of Issachar were told, know the times and the seasons. They knew the times and the seasons, so they knew what Israel should do. And if we understand just how far certain of these things that are abominations and plagues that we were told were coming are to literally becoming unignorable any longer, then we got a pretty good handle on how late in the season it is. So here's another such story. This one comes from a, it was an interview that was up on King World News. They do some pretty good stories. And this is an analyst in Singapore, whom I like. His name's William Kay, or Bill Kay. And he was commenting on the recent article, which I'm going to do in just a second, from the maestro himself, former Fed chief Alan Greenspan. And you may remember, this is kind of funny. Back in the 1960s, Greenspan was an acolyte of the famous objectivist and free marketeer Ayn Rand. And even way back then, Ayn Rand once said, well, Alan's always been a social climber. Well, he was. And, of course, he literally, I think, sold his soul for rock and roll, or better still, to be the Fed chairman. And he was the guy that brought you quantitative easing to infinity and ZERP, zero interest rate policies, and a series of ever bigger bubbles. He said famously, I'm going to beat the Kondratiev wave. In other words, Kondratiev wave, Elliott wave, all of these are things that kind of sort of go directly to Scripture, too. If you don't do the reset that the Creator says every 50 years on the Jubilee, what happens is you get a Great Depression about once every human lifetime, just a little bit longer. So it's kind of like he says, here, do the reset. If you don't, it's going to be really bad, and indeed, that's what history has shown. Well, anyway, in 1966, literally 50 years ago, practically, Greenspan wrote a famous essay entitled Gold and Economic Freedom. And I've referenced it frequently, where he says, gold is the only anchor, basically, that that a free money system has. Otherwise, people will do crooked things. And here the same guy, later on, turns his back on all that and does those same crooked things. Now, here's the story today. And I'll quote Bill Kay. Quote, "It was astounding," he told the interviewer. "Greenspan has now made a complete U-turn." And he begins to recount a little bit of Greenspan's career. He was publicly a disciple of Ayn Rand and a gold apostle. But then, when he got a little bit closer to being in government, he changed his tune altogether, like Ben Bernanke, his successor. He acted publicly as if he was clueless about the role of gold in the world's financial architecture. When he was asked about gold, and I remember because I used to interview Ron Paul, almost like clockwork, every time Greenspan would testify before Congress. And Ron Paul could always be counted on to ask him a question about gold, and he would basically pontificate and obfuscate. "Well, gold is a legacy of a prior era. A barbarous relic," was the way John Maynard Keynes used to put it, of a bygone era. That's not what he said many years earlier. And here, he has now come out with yet another story. This reversal on gold, says Bill Kay, is fascinating. Here's the guy who's been the former Fed head, and look what he's saying now. So this was published. The article that I'm looking at now is by Alan Greenspan. It is called "The Golden Rule, Why Beijing is Buying." And guess where it appeared? In the Journal of the, Big Brothers New World Order Central. If you're not familiar with it, it's called Foreign Affairs. It's published by the CFR, the Council on Foreign Relations. And I'm going to suggest to you what I thought was interesting about this story. It's not quite as much of a reversal as Bill Kay is trying to suggest here. I think it's really a better example of the 80-20 rule. Because if you listen carefully, you'll see that Greenspan is greasing the skids and lying beautifully with the 80-20 rule. Here's what it says. Here's the first line. "If," he says, "China were to convert a relatively modest part of its $4 trillion in foreign exchange reserves into gold, the country's currency could take on unexpected strength in today's international financial system. It'd be a gamble, of course," he says, "for China to do that and attempt to buy enough gold bullion to displace the United States from its position as the world's largest holder of gold." We'll stop right there. China has been converting, and Greenspan knows it. Not just a modest part, but a significant part of their dollar-denominated foreign paper into gold. They're the biggest buyer of gold in the world. Arguably, they now may be the biggest holder of gold in the world. He knows all of that. And that's why I think this is such an incredibly slick piece of lying and an example of the 80-20 rule. In other words, he keeps saying if, talking in the future tense, if China was to do that, then the yuan could take on unexpected strength. Who'd have thought it? Answer? You do, you liar, because you know it's already happened. It's a lie cloaked in truth. Then he goes on to say this, Greenspan still, "The broader issue, a return to the gold standard in any form, is nowhere on anybody's horizon." Bull. Okay, and what he's doing here, literally, is greasing the skids. It's a classic example of what, during the Clinton administration, they used to call inoculation. We got all these women that are going to come forward and say that Clinton raped them. There were at least five that they knew about. So they literally had a bimbo eruption team saying, you know, Bill's such an attractive guy. Women just throw themselves on him, and he has to fight them off with a stick. Yeah, I did not have sex, but hey, I tried to humor him a little bit. Bit a few, maybe. Slapped a few around, but they love it. And then when the story comes out, they say, see, well, we've already been upfront about all that. This way Greenspan can say, oh, yeah, see, I told you it was going to happen, knowing full well that when he wrote the story, it was already, again, a done deal. So these kinds of things, I think, are, again, the mileposts along the road. Know the times and the seasons, and we're literally there. A couple more stories. We'll do these a little bit more quickly here. The man who executed QE1 for the Fed, the first round of quantitative easing, his name is Andrew Hutsar. He was former managing director at Morgan Stanley after that, and he warned that people's savings of a lifetime could be wiped out in a blink of an eye if we had another 2008-style meltdown, because at this point, the Fed has, well, they've spent all their bullets, and they don't have much to do other than to try to create money without limit, and he doesn't think they can do that, although I tend to think they'll try. because it's the only choice they've got. You know, if every tool in your toolbox is a hammer, then every problem looks like a nail. He said this, remember that woman who revealed these Goldman Sachs tape? Everybody's talking about that in Wall Street. Everybody's on it, in on it. Wall Street is now obviously running everything. The leverage is through the roof. There's no way to stop this monster. And then they hearken back to Greenspan, too, who said in a speech famously a few years back, we stand ready to create money without limit. So the interviewer asked the question of Hazar, could the whole system, the whole fiat money system, just blow up? And the answer was, well, yeah. We have an issue of an overly financialized U.S. economy where the banking sector is twice as big as it was 30 years ago. Wall Street is now the largest corporate sector in America, and it's responsible for one-third of all U.S. corporate profits. So where do we go from here? We haven't made any of the hard choices. We haven't done anything to let the economy correct. Things are worse than they were in 2008, the structural weakness hasn't been addressed, and the average American wage is down to where it was in the late 1980s. All we've done is pump money into the economy to stimulate it very efficiently, and the only benefits really went to Wall Street and the banks. So he says we're in line for a correction. We'll see more volatility. All you guys have heard this. We've been talking about this for a long time. It's just that more and more insiders are now coming out and telling you what the conspiracy theorists were saying not too long ago. The American public has already lost 40% of their wealth since 2008, and Wall Street's balance sheet blew up in the years before 2008. Now the Fed has taken that over, and literally since they're out of bullets, the question is, when the next panic happens, what are they going to do about it? A fellow who is the head of the investment bank and their analyst team at Societe Generale in Europe. They've been ranked number one for global strategy since the year 2007, and he's named Albert Edwards. They call him a perennial pessimist at Bloomberg because he has a history, they say, of saying unpleasant things that few people want to hear. Quote, my role, he said, is to step back from the excessive enthusiasm that builds up in the market and just say, this is wrong. This is going to go horribly wrong. And he points to Japan and says it's probably going to lead the way. We haven't had a recovery. The next big trouble spot is China. And basically, watch the Japanese yen and recognize that when it collapses, then the other currencies will go down with it because, well, they'll have to in order to stay competitive. And that will squeeze developed economies that haven't yet recovered from the financial crisis. So basically, there's another high-profile person. In his case, he's been saying it for a while, coming out and saying, watch it, we're very close to an economic tipping point. Now, if that's true, then, well, what else are we going to see? Probably a whole lot of other bad stuff at the same time. And, of course, that brings us to Ebola. I suspect most people have heard this, but we'll do it briefly, too. The Dallas hospital, where the patient number one, as they're calling him now in America, the guy literally came to the hospital, said, hey, I've been in Liberia. I feel really bad. Well, they told him, take two aspirin, call me in the morning. Actually, what they did is they sent him home with antibiotics. He roamed around the city of Dallas, infecting people, probably, for 2 days. Before finally literally going into projectile vomiting, they sent an ambulance to pick him up. He vomited outside of his apartment. He vomited all over the ambulance on the way to the hospital. And then they confirmed he does have Ebola. Which flight did he come over on? Well, it was several stops along the way. And for the longest time, I don't even know if they've actually come clean yet. CDC was hiding the information from the American people about where he was. And then they've been lying to folks, too. I call it now the Center for Deadly Contamination because, again, the human heart is desperately wicked. When you put all the pieces together and ask the question, did they know what was going on here? Are they really that stupid? No. I think they're that evil, folks. They hold a patent on Ebola. It certainly looks like, and there have been a number of good doctors come forward and say, because we can't find patient zero in West Africa, what probably happened instead was somebody was testing a vaccine. Maybe it didn't work quite right, and instead of being a cure, it ended up infecting people. That can happen with vaccines because it sometimes includes a live or killed virus. And if it doesn't work quite right, guess what? You may get the disease that it's supposed to try to inoculate you against. That's the way it's supposed to work. In any case, somehow or other, it got out. CDC has been hyping it for all it's worth, telling people not to worry, not to worry. This can't possibly happen. Obama was famously quoted as saying, no chance of it happening. And then here it is. And they had the guy and then discharged him so he could go out and infect more people. Originally they said, well, he may have come in contact with a dozen or more. Then it was 80, as the last number I heard was over 100 people that they have said could have been infected. Furthermore, they have ordered a shutdown, quarantining the people in the fellow's family, literally stationed armed guards outside. Evidently they're planning on shooting to kill if need to, there'll be a lot of people saying, well, the ends justify the means. Let's do that. Right? Our safety, we'll trade your liberty for our safety any day. Now here's where the plot thickens. Like I said, the Texas family has been ordered into a 21-day lockdown. They've also been told that they are Achtung, being ordered. When we say bend over, you will bend over. You will provide blood samples to authorities on demand. You will agree to any testing by state public health officials on demand. And you'll immediately report any symptoms to Dallas County Health and Human Services, said CBS News. And so those conspiracy theorists that have been saying this is planned and going to happen in America, and they were told, no, it could never happen here, are now saying, I told you so. I'm looking at a piece by Mike Adams. Yep, we're seeing forced isolation, medical quarantines, forced medical interventions, forced blood draws, and armed camps. They've stationed guards outside here. The good news is they're not yet sending people off to concentration camps, but hey, this is just one family. It's easier to station guards around them than it is to send them off somewhere, and besides which, we don't want to alarm the slaves yet. But understand, the community health centers, they won't call them concentration camps. They'll call them something cutesy pie. They're next on the horizon. Here's the story that came out today that really kind of, bugged me. Tom Frieden, the director of the Center for Deadly Contamination and Promulgation, on Friday said that restricting travel, now get this, no, we're not going to bother to shut down the airlines between U.S. and West Africa, because that might backfire and somehow could put more Americans at risk of contracting Ebola. He doesn't exactly tell you what that logical leap is there, but he says, when he was asked about prohibiting air travel between the U.S. and West Africa, that such a restriction would be ineffective. That might be true, and it might make it harder for health officials to root out the virus. Now, here's the unspoken part, folks, but when it comes to concentration camps, hey, we're fine with that. We've been planning on that all along. That's why Obama signed the executive order. So do you catch the hypocrisy here? No, we can't shut the border. We can't prevent people from flying in, but we can sure as hell put you in a hell on earth and ship you off to a concentration camp. We'll force you to give us blood, and we'll force our vaccinations into you, whether you like it or not. He said, well, people have a right to return. Good grief. Well, they used to have a right to travel, too. What happened to that? Here's another story. Disaster teams were notified, according to a bunch of tweets that have now appeared. Golden State Fire and EMS and other so-called Disaster Area Response Team, or DART teams, were told months ago that they would be activated in October. What an amazing coincidence. Turns out they were right. When it comes to the after effects of the Ebola pandemic panic, here's a story from Mike Adams. He had several interesting stories out this week. This goes to show you, folks, what will happen. And as of yet, all we've had is the Ebola card played. The first Ebola victim is big news. The 10,000th, probably just a statistic. Will they stop it? Will they, the Elohim, provide the magic vaccine? Well, there's a story on that here coming up, too. But I thought this was interesting when it comes to planning and preparation. In one day after the announcement of the Dallas situation, the sales of Tyvek full-body suits, and they noted that they'd been recommended by Natural News, rose 143,000% in one day. The plot thickens more. Here's We'll do these, let's see, two stories. And I'll do them in this order. First off, this is another one from John Benson at Natural News. More proof that the West African Ebola crisis is a total fraud. Again, there are reports, and I tend to believe them personally, because Lynn Horowitz has been talking about this for the better part of 20 years at this point, that Ebola is a bioengineered by multiple countries, including the Russians and including the United States, to be weaponized, probably already aerosolized, to be airborne. And certainly, as many folks have pointed out, if you're going to develop a bioweapon, you develop the vaccine in parallel so that the good folks, those that you don't want to be infected, don't. On the other hand, maybe we have a grade B vaccine for the people that we don't care so much about, and maybe that's what was being. Who knows? The point is, we're not being told the truth here. But what we are seeing is a whole bunch of indications, contradictions that point out the lie. Here's one of them: researchers at Oxford University in the UK are now ready to begin testing a vaccine for Ebola. It's magically been produced, not in years, as is usually the requirement, but in weeks. Hey, it's almost like a Star Trek plot. You'd think Bones was working in the lab there with Captain Kirk. We'll have the vaccine before noon, Captain. Anyway, it magically appeared out of nowhere. They say there's plans to administer it already to 10,000 health workers by the end of the year, and it is a product of drug giant GlaxoSmithKline in partnership with the U.S. National Institutes of Health, who just happens to hold, along with the CDC and the Big Brother government itself, the patents for Ebola. They've been fast-tracking the vaccine among the panic over, quote, the worst Ebola outbreak in history. Everybody's now in crisis mode. Normally it takes years for this to happen, says the BBC. Hey, you got to be careful with trials. Make sure that there aren't side effects when we test it on humans. That's a normal violation of ethics. But now we've short-circuited all of that. Only minimal testing will take place on just 60 healthy volunteers, all of whom will be injected with genetic material derived from both Ebola and a common cold virus. And it just shows that, hey, when the money's right, we can do this stuff real fast. And, of course, when the rules are relaxed and we don't have to worry about ethics and all that kind of stuff, why, cross my palm with silver and we'll get it done quickly. CDC is in on the scam, says the piece, as the agency filed its own patent way back in 2007 on the Ebola virus. And the patent claims any genome that looks like 70% match, they're going to say, is ours. They only want to protect you, and they also want to be your authorized vaccine distributor. Now, here's the part of the plot that I think really reveals the bottom line. Let me ask this question. Give me some ones if you've heard about NSF and their plans to test nanosilver in West Africa. NSF stands for Natural Solutions Foundation. This is Dr. Rima Liebau and her group. They've gone and dealt with a number of the West African governments in Sierra Leone and other places over there. And essentially, they got those governments to say, yeah, hey, what's the problem with silver, right? It's been used for a long time. Whether it's effective or not, it sure isn't going to cause any problems. We know that because people have been using it for thousands of years, maybe not in the quality that we now have it, but certainly it's an herbal or natural remedy that's been around forever. So Natural Solutions Foundation agreed with the cooperation of several governments to ship 200 bottles of 10 part per million nanosilver into Sierra Leone. Guess what? They paid $3,400 to ship it air express, and it never made it out of Paris. The shipment has been refused three times without being delivered to Africa. Air France can't tell us why. But get this. The World Health Organization is behind, that's who, has been behind squelching the multiple shipments of nanosilver into Africa, leaving, as the story says here, thousands to suffer needlessly. WHO officials reportedly called off the trials at an Ebola isolation ward where local health authorities were set to begin administering the silver, which the U.S. government even has previously admitted, and I'll come back to that, is highly effective against Ebola. WHO ordered the trial not to proceed Now, these are the same folks that said, hey, when it comes to our vaccines, we'll break all the rules, because if it kills a few people, hey, you got to break some eggs to make an omelet. But no, no, don't you dare give these folks silver. Other experimental treatments, fine. Well, why? I guess it's because Big Pharma is on board with those, but come on. Who owns the patents for silver? Who stands to make hundreds of billions? Well, we can't have that. So when it comes to using therapeutic silver, all bets are off. And it looks like WHO and the U.S. Center for Disease Contamination and Promulgation have given their blessing to experimental therapies for Ebola, except for natural herbal and silver stuff. People are dying, says the conclusion. Bureaucrats are playing politics with silver. No, it's worse than that, folks. The human heart is desperately wicked. Who can know it? Get this. Turns out that the U.S. Department of Defense published a paper back in 2008. It was formerly classified. It's actually been released. The U.S. and other waste-stream media has completely ignored it. But the conclusion was that antimicrobial silver solutions, like the exact kind NSF is trying to deliver into Africa, have been proven beneficial in fighting Ebola and other forms of hemorrhagic fevers. A presentation entitled, quote, Silver Nanoparticles Neutralize Hemorrhagic Fever Viruses, which revealed exactly what the name suggests, has been buried and kept secret for years. In essence, investigators determined then that simple silver solutions can neutralize many viruses, including the arenavirus and filovirus, both of which are related to Ebola. Hey, they're probably gene-spliced, along with the pig genes, to create the newest patented variant. Now, the research was conducted with the backing of the Department of Defense and the Defense Threat Reduction Agency, or DTRA, and U.S. SATCOM, or STRATCOM, for combating WMDs, applied by biotechnology branch. And not a single waste stream source is telling people about this. Surprise, surprise. I am suggesting that there really is wickedness in the world, and that had people been able to recognize, let's just say in the 1930s, how wicked the Nazis were, or indeed how wicked so many people who are attracted to positions of power and who become Caligulas and others are. Well, history repeats itself. The prophecies are still gonna play out because mankind ultimately hasn't changed. This story also, this is something that you that have listened for a while will recognize that we've talked about here. ISIS. So there's a piece, and some of you know who Waleed Shubat is. He is a former Muslim turned Christian, and does some pretty good work. And I don't fault him for this. I just think it's unfortunately a little bit naive. And it goes like this. ISIS has threatened the United States, he says, and its allies, to spread the Ebola virus if they continue to wage war on ISIS inside Syria and Iraq. Who's kidding who, folks? The war isn't on ISIS. ISIS is U.S. armed and trained. No, the war is a ruse so that they can attack the pipelines and Bashar al-Assad, because his pipelines basically don't serve U.S. interests, don't get paid with U.S. dollars. They look the other side. And ISIS, though, has come out. They got a press release here that Waleed and his son Theodore Shubat are quoting, saying that their members can synthesize and produce Ebola and coronaviruses, and they say that followers and soldiers of the Islamic State are mostly suicide bombers. All of them are ready, they say, not only to carry Ebola, but to drink Ebola if they are asked to carry and spread it in the United States. This is not difficult, but we need a decision from the jihadist leaders. Now, here's where I stop. And say, just like the situation with Alan Greenspan, don't believe that for a second. Future tense, they know that this, just like the gold situation, has already happened. The borders are wide open. Anybody that had half a brain that was a real terrorist knew darn well you could go over and serve on a death crew, get yourself one of thousands of dead bodies from Ebola, eat their flesh, drink their blood, do whatever you want. Any fool can catch the disease. And then hurry, hurry, come across the southern border and preserve the material. It's trivial. It's easy. Again, a fool could do it. Heck, we had a guy stupid enough to do it, walk into a hospital, and they were stupid enough to turn him away. He turned himself in. How many people have walked across the southern borders? Answer, I don't know. But any that were planning on coming are already here. They go on to say Ebola can easily be transmitted through bodily fluids, sweat, blood, tears, saliva, urine, semen, etc., and things that come into contact with body fluids, like bed sheets, clothing, needles, car seats in taxi cabs and subways, you name it. Carts in shopping centers and grocery stores. The process of cultivating the disease, said ISIS, can be done by any student. They don't need complex labs. Even a makeshift lab is good enough, and so forth and so on. Meanwhile, you got people that are supposed experts. I won't quote this guy's name. It comes from Carnegie Mellon. Said, by the time a would-be martyr came to America, the symptoms of Ebola would be conspicuously displayed on his person. He wouldn't get past customs. Excuse my bluntness here. Bull! Beep! It's unmitigated bull. It's a lie. They're telling you that it's not airborne. Well, I guarantee you the people that developed it know exactly how they have weaponized it and in what forms the various patented variants that they've got are airborne or not airborne. The nature of a military weapon is you understand how to use it and deploy it. Turns out, too, that ISIS could use animals as well, especially bats, they say, to carry Ebola into America because bats are particularly good at it. And the Hajj pilgrimage to Mecca is coming up soon, too. That would be another place for a theater of operations. There's all kinds of information like this. The point I'm trying to make is the stuff that people are being fed in the news is unmitigated lies. Don't worry, be happy, don't panic. Everything is in control. The Elohim here will fix it. The Elohim have been lying. A month ago they were saying Ebola can't possibly come. But they were signing executive orders saying, well, if it does come, we're going to take away what's left of your God-given rights and have the ability to put you in a concentration camp. No ifs, ands, or buts, no questions asked, and we'll get you to beg for it. We'll make it such a big deal on TV that you'll have people in Dallas and other places saying, hey, yes, put them in the camps. Stuff them in the ships. Put them wherever we say to put them. Just protect me at all costs because you are the mighty ones, and I can't trust that God of the Bible to protect me. I got all kinds of stories here about biometric IDs in Venezuela, how the strings are being tightened down there, and, you know, similar stuff. Why is the USDA buying submachine guns as if we didn't already know? Panel came out earlier this week and said, guess what the problem is at the Newtown Massacre? What are we going to do? Answer, crack down on homeschooling. Surprise, surprise. I'll skip a bunch of other news. There's a little bit of good news. Two stories quickly. One of them comes from a Cody Wilson, the defense distributed nonprofit organization that a few months ago made some headlines because they produced a Liberator 3D pistol that could be printed on a 3D printer, and now they came out within the last couple days with something they call the Ghost Runner. It's about 1 cubic foot. It's a little box that is a CNC, a computer-controlled milling machine, and it's specially configured to let anybody make the aluminum body, the lower, for an AR-15 rifle at home. No regulation, no expertise, no serial numbers. He planned on producing 110 of these things. Instead, he ended up selling the entire lot, more than 200, for $1,200 in the first 24 hours, and that was beyond his expectations. He says he's going to hire more people and build more of them. People want the ability to keep and bear arms and to do things that Big Brother doesn't control. They want this battle rifle and the ability to produce more of them. Imagine that. By the same token, this story is almost funny, and it's, I think, interesting. In California, the number of parents deciding not to vaccinate their children is growing at what the state considers an alarming rate. The number of people who have refused to have their kiddies vaccinated has doubled in just the last 7 years, and the percentage of kindergartners at which at least 8% of the students, and they say, oh, that's a concern, when our propaganda isn't working so well, at least 8% of the students are not fully vaccinated because of their personal beliefs, has doubled too. And I guess maybe that's good news. It doesn't mean that people have come completely on board yet and they're beginning to turn away from the fake Elohim and get back to the real stuff, but it does at least mean that more and more of them are beginning to realize the old saying, when their lips are moving, they're lying. I'll wrap it. I won't do this later. We'll talk about it in more detail if there are some questions, perhaps tomorrow. But Mike Adams did a great story over the last few days called The Five Biggest Lies About Ebola that are being pushed in the mainstream press. Number one, this is obviously false on its face. Ebola can never come to the United States, okay? Number two, Ebola is only spread via direct contact with body fluids. That's a lie, and perhaps it explains how come there have been literally hundreds of healthcare workers who take good precautions and are, well, they're drinking this Kool-Aid, evidently, and have come down. Many have died because something that they're being told isn't quite true. Lie number three, don't worry, healthcare authorities have everything under control. Lie number four, there's no hope except for the magic of a vaccine. Well, thankfully, we've been lying to you about that. We have told you it's not ready, and in fact, we've had it ready for a long time. We'll release it when you're pining for it and clamoring for it and begging for it enough that you're willing to take it come hell or high water. Anyway, the only defense, lie number four, is a vaccine or a pharmaceutical drug. And, of course, he points out, no, we're fearfully and wonderfully made. He doesn't put it that way. I will. Our immune system is truly an amazing piece of engineering. And if we would just let it work the way God designed it, we're capable of fighting off all kinds of things. Does that mean there won't be some people die? No. But it does mean that if you destroy your immune system eating stuff that he says is not food, like pigs and shellfish, and now genetically modified frankenfoods and poisons and neurotoxins like aspartame and MSG and all kinds of other stuff, you can destroy the immune system to the point where ultimately it doesn't work the way it's supposed to. It's almost like people have been planning on doing that. Witness what's happening with the EV-D68 that is streaming through the vaccinated population of kiddies. And last I saw it, pushing 40 states, and many of them now have come down with some paralysis-like diseases that seem to be a variant. This is well, I guess about the thing you could say is it looks like plagues, biblical plagues coming down. Line number five, Ebola came out of nowhere, and it was a random fluke of nature. Nope, it was a population control weapon, and it was designed and patented. And people have known that for the better part of a decade and a half. All right. Any other questions or comments? What we want to do is we'll have another song here. And when we come back with all of that as a preface, yes, the human heart is desperately wicked. And yes, there is evil in the world. And if there was ever, ever, ever a time for people to get on their knees and pray and make teshuva and return to his instruction, his Torah, it's now. So we'll come back in just a minute.
You are Lord of creation and Lord of my life, Lord of the land and the sea. You are Lord of the heavens before there was time, and Lord of all lords you will be. Bow down and we worship Yahweh, we bow down and we worship Yahweh, we bow down and we worship Yahweh. King of all kings you will be. You are King of creation and King of my life, King of the land and the sea. You were King of the heavens before there was time, and King of all kings you will be. We bow down and we worship Yahweh, we bow down and we worship Yahweh, we bow down and we worship Yahweh. King of all kings you will be. Lord of all lords you will be. King of all kings you will be.
Okay, let's talk about the Torah portion for this week. And again, as I mentioned earlier, this week, the normal, the traditional breakdown of the Torah, because this is the last Shabbat before Yom Kippur, the 10th day of the 7th month, is to read primarily Leviticus chapter 16. But of course, there's another place, and that's where I want to start as well, that there's actually more than one place. But another place that talks about it in the book of Leviticus is chapter 23, verse 27. But I'm going to take a little bit of a run at it. We'll start with the first of the fall feasts, which begins in verse 24. So this is Leviticus 23:23. And Yahuwah spoke unto Moshe, saying, verse 24, speak unto the children of Israel, and say to them, in the 7th month, on the first day of the month, is a solemn rest unto you, a memorial, proclaimed with a blast of horns, Yom Teruah, a holy convocation. And then it says this, you shall do no manner of servile work, bring an offering made by fire unto Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. So, the distinction is, we have this special day, that is signified with blowing of the shofar. We did that last week. You are to do no manner of servile work on it. There's a qualification. So oftentimes you'll hear this referred to as a cooking Sabbath because it is generally understood, well, it's servile work. This is like going to a job and being hired out. But doesn't mean you can't do some cooking or that kind of thing on this day. Again, that is at least the way servile work is generally been interpreted. I don't have a problem with that particular understanding, and I'm not going to argue with people to say, well, maybe it means this, maybe it means that. But the contrast comes in verse 26, having to do with this coming special, holy, set-apart day. But, it says, Akah, how be it, is one way. In other words, as Rashi points out, when you see these Hebrew words, but, or howbeit, those things that get translated that way, it's a restrictive term. Something is being contrasted with the holy day that we just talked about. Howbeit, but on the 10th day of the 7th month, that's the one that's coming up, Monday if you look at the sighted moon anyway, is the day of atonement, and it's Yom HaKippurim. This shall be a holy convocation unto you. You shall afflict your souls, it says. I'll come back to that in the Hebrew. And you shall bring an offering made by fire. And then verse 28 says, and you shall do no manner of work in that same day. It doesn't qualify it. No servile work. It says no manner of work, basically whatsoever. For this is the day of atonement, to make atonement to you before Yahuwah Elohechem, the Lord your God. Yahuwah, your God. And then it says this. This is a part that I think is particularly important to point out. On the chat room, as people were coming in and talking earlier, somebody pointed out, well, even Glenn Beck, you know, is saying, oh, maybe we shouldn't have done away with Yom Kippur. Well, who's we? The creator of the universe never did away with it. He says it here. It's a statute forever throughout your generations and all your dwellings. What about that is not clear. Yeah, there have been whores and whore churches that have said, we know better than God. We're changing all of that. But he has never said such a thing. As a matter of fact, the one that they claim to worship as Mashiach said, I'm not changing the smallest part, not one yod or tittle. Well, who are they going to believe, him? Or the popes and potentates and priests and pastors that have been lying about it for the better part of 2,000 years. This is as clear as it can be. You are to do these things. Do no manner of work. It is a statute forever throughout your generations. Now, if that's not clear enough, here's the part that I think is really important. I started with the news. Things are getting really ugly out there. We've got an economic meltdown. When we have an economic meltdown, we almost always, when it's of the degree, and this is the biggest one, the biggest debt bubble in human history, maybe it'll be the biggest war in human history. But we usually, even with little ones that are compared to this one, we usually get a world war, or a big war, or something dramatic to distract people. You can go back into the Bible and see similar things. isn't it a great time to consider, hey, if he says we should be making atonement, going before him, praying, and all of this stuff seems to be coming right down right now, don't you think maybe we ought to be listening, reading what it says? All right, tenth day, seventh month, you're to afflict your souls. Do no manner of work in that day. It is a day of atonement, to make atonement for you before Yahuwah Eloheka. For whoever, whatever soul, he says, it is that is not afflicted in that same day, he shall be cut off from his people. Now, I have people tell me, oh, yeah, I got to work on Yom Kippur. How bad do you have to work? Remember the line from Bill Cosby? Noah, right? How long can you tread water? Do you really have to work so bad that it's worth being cut off? Not listening to what the creator of the universe says, particularly at a time such as this? He says it again, you shall do no manner of work. It's a statute forever throughout your generations in all your dwellings. It shall be unto you a Sabbath of solemn rest. You're to afflict your souls on the ninth day of the month at evening. From evening unto evening, you shall keep this Shabbat. All right, so it's clear. I guess we'll go through some of the details in a minute. But one of the questions always come up. Now, I'm not going to tell people, if you don't do this, I say, bad stuff's going to happen. No, don't misread me. I'm just reading what it says. And I would encourage you. You have family members that don't believe it. Well, you can't convince them. Maybe he can. All you have to do, though, is just show them where this is. So, read Leviticus 23, verses 26 through, oh, let's say 33, and see what he says. See if it isn't crystal clear. We'll go back again in just a second. The other place is the entirety of chapter 16, where it tells us some more about some of the history and some of the things that were done on this day, and that's very educational. But the word that always kind of tends to be problematic, the one that people say, well, what does that mean? Well, we have this idea of no servile work. That's clearly a qualification that says, well, it doesn't say absolutely and positively no work whatsoever, like this day does. It says no servile work. So at least it's some kind of work that's okay, another kind of work that's not okay. On the day of Yom Kippur, however, no work, period. That's easy. At least I think it's pretty easy. If it sounds like work, got any questions about it? Well, don't do it. But what does it mean to afflict your souls? Now, the Hebrew root word there is anah, and it's in the peel conjugation. What does that mean? Well, it's kind of emphatic is the way I like to put it. If you have a word that means to break something in Hebrew, and I can't remember what it is, but this is the example I always like to hearken to. The normal conjugation of the word, let's just call it that way, would be to break something. But then when you conjugate it in the peel conjugation, the same root word, but now it means to smash it, to smithereens. Okay, it's kind of emphatic. So you've got this idea of afflicting or humbling yourself or bowing down, anah. And then when you put it in the peel conjugation, like in this case here, it is to afflict. Well, generally, that has been taken to mean a fast. And oftentimes it's a fast of food and water. Again, I'm not going to tell you what it has to mean for you. I just would encourage people to pray about it and see what it is that you think would qualify. Because the goal here is to get right with Him, to return to Shuva, and get right with... I also don't have a problem with those who do the little traditional things that involve going and repenting and calling up people that have wronged you or that you've wronged and say, I'm sorry. How can we get this relationship repaired? This is a day for doing those kind of things. That first use of the word anah, by the way, comes in Genesis 15:13, and it's Abraham that is being told by the Father the following. You know the story. Know for a surety, the creator of the universe says to Abram, before he gets the extra hey in his name, know of a surety, your seed will be a stranger in a land that's not theirs, and shall serve them. And they, meaning the Egyptians, he doesn't know who it is yet, but they shall anah them, afflict them for 400 years. Not too much later, we find that Sarai afflicts, same word, Hagar, an Egyptian. Now, isn't that kind of interesting? The first two uses of this same word refer to bondage and the captivity in Egypt. Know that your seed, Abraham is told, or Abram at that point prophetically, will be afflicted by the Egyptians, and then, not too much later, Sarai, his wife, then afflicts the Egyptian handmaid, Hagar. Well, we'll just leave it at that. Now, the next thing I want to do is talk a little bit about, I guess, what we'd have to call some spirituality as we go through here. Because when you look at the story of the Azazel, as it's called, the scapegoat in English, it's hard not to say, okay, boy, there's a whole lot of parallels that fit with this story. So let's go through it at least a little bit of detail. I won't read all of chapter 16, but I'll kind of summarize it. We did this portion not long ago. It was called Achremot, After the Death. And that's how chapter 16 begins. Achremot spoke Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh unto Moshe after the death of those two sons of Abram, Nadab and Abihu. Remember, they brought strange fire. And then Moshe is told, speak to your brother. Tell him he's not to come just any old time into the set-apart place, the Holy of Holies within the veil before the ark cover, which is upon the ark, that he die not. For I appear in the cloud upon the ark cover. And by the way, that word there is Ha-Kippuret. Recognize the root? Same as Yom Ha-Kippurim. It is the cover. In this case, it's the cover for the ark. So, here's how Aaron's to come into the holy place. With a young bull for a sin offering and a ram for a burnt offering. Then it describes what he's to do. He's to bathe his flesh. There is a very specific procedure, and it's probably important, because if he doesn't do it right, he might die yes, as opposed to die not. He presents the offering, the bullock of the sin offering, for him, himself. He makes atonement for himself and his house. And then it gets around to telling us he shall take these two goats, and he sets them before Yahuwah at the door of the tent of meeting. He casts lots upon the two goats. Now, the historic and traditional teaching of this is these goats are supposed to be identical. If one is clearly better than the other one, or they're clearly different, why, you know, it kind of makes sense. Why bother to cast lots for them? But the casting lot concept seems to be, well, you know, six of one, half a dozen of another. Pick either one. They're identical. What difference does it make? We will let Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh decide which one is for which. He casts lots upon them, and it says one lot for Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, the other lot for Azazel. Now, what is Azazel? Well, let's talk about what happens to him first, and we'll come back and maybe we'll answer the question, because it's a good question, and it's something that confuses people, and maybe we don't know. Aaron shall present the goat for which the lot fell for Yahuwah, offer him for a sin offering. Now, one of the things that you'll notice here is this: the goat that is the scapegoat, Azazel, actually survives this process. The lot for Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh is offered up. Sacrificed. But the goat on which the lot fell for Azazel shall be set alive before Yahuwah to make atonement over him, to send him away for Azazel into the wilderness. Now, one other comment I'll make here. That word there is shalach. It's the same word. It means to send out. It's actually a pretty common word in Hebrew. You send somebody out of the house. When a man sends away his wife, it's the putting away phase of the process that, if he gives her a get, would then be called divorce in English. But the putting away is what Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh says he hates in Malachi. But it's the same word, shalach. Well, here is this goat being sent away, put away into the wilderness. Aaron presents the bull of the sin offering for himself. He makes atonement for himself, his house. He kills the bull, which is for himself. He takes a censer full of coals. He puts it in his hands, full of sweet incense, beaten small. He brings it within the veil. He puts the incense upon the fire before Yahuwah. The cloud of incense covers the ark cover that is upon the testimony that he die not. He takes the blood. He sprinkles it with his finger upon the ark cover. And before the ark cover, he sprinkles of the blood seven times. Then he kills the goat of the sin offering that is for the people, and bring that blood, his blood, within the veil, and do with his blood as he did with the blood of the bullock. So the first bull is for Aaron and his house. The second, the one that is the goat for Yahuwah, Yahuwah, is sacrificed for the people, and its blood is sprinkled upon the ark cover and before the ark cover. He makes atonement for the holy place because of the uncleanness of the children of Israel, because of their transgressions, even all of their sins. And so he shall do for the tent of meeting that dwells with them in the midst of their uncleanness. And there's no man in the tent of meeting when he goes in to make atonement for the holy place, in the holy place, until he comes out. He's made atonement for himself and for his household and for coal of the assembly, kol kahal, that word, the kahal there, the church, the assembly of Israel. He goes out under the altar before Yahuwah, makes atonement for it, takes the blood of the bullock, the blood of the goat, puts it upon the horns of the altar round about, sprinkles it seven times, cleanses it, hallows it from the uncleanness of the children of Israel. And when he has made an end of atoning for that holy place and the tent of meeting and the altar, he is to lay both his hands upon the head of the live goat and confess over the live goat all of the iniquities, the Torahlessness, the transgressions of the B'nai Israel, all their transgressions, even all their sins. He puts them upon the head of the goat, and he sends him away, shalachs him again, by the hand of an appointed man out into the wilderness. And the goat, it says in verse 22, shall bear upon him all of their iniquities into a land which is cut off. He lets the goat go in the wilderness. Aaron comes into the tent of meeting, puts off the linen garments, which he put on. He bathes his flesh in water in a set-apart place, puts on his other vestments, and he comes out. He offers his burnt offering and the burnt offering of the people, and he makes atonement for himself and for the people. The fat of the sin offering he makes smoke upon the altar. And then the fellow that lets the atzatzel, the goat for atzatzel, in the wilderness, shall wash his clothes. He bathes his flesh, and after that he can come back into the camp. The goat and the bull sin offering, whose blood was brought to make atonement in the holy place, they are to be carried forth outside of the camp. They burn in fire their skins, their flesh, and their dung. The fellow that burns them, he's to wash his clothes, bathe his flesh in water too, and after that, he too can come back in the camp. Now it says this, and this shall be a statute forever unto you. In the seventh month, on the tenth day of the month, coming up, next couple of days, you shall afflict your souls, anah, and shall do no manner of work. Not you, the homeborn, or the stranger that sojourns among you. None of you. For this day shall atonement be made for you, to cleanse you from all your sins shall you be clean before Yahuwah. Now, the sages will point out that there is a requirement here, and their requirement is teshuvah. You got to genuinely want to have this happen. And that, by the way, is how that that conditional word, but, or how be it, in chapter 23, is generally understood to read in the Hebrew. Again, I think it makes pretty good sense. In other words, you don't just, because somebody once did it somewhere, if you're not doing the things that it says to do. This is to be a Sabbath of solemn rest, says the next verse. Afflict your souls. It is a statute forever. This is, last verse in the chapter, an everlasting statute unto you to make atonement for the children of Israel because of all their sins once a year. What about this is not clear? Oh, that was just up until Jesus. Where does it say that? He says forever. Everlasting statute. We know that there are lots of places in Scripture, including Sukkot, in Zechariah that it tells us that in the land, in the kingdom that comes after the return of the Mashiach, we'll still be doing these things. Heaven and earth still exist. Is he a liar or is he telling the truth? The question, of course, is who is to be master? Who is the one who gets to say what's true? Answer, if it's his word and it's him and we believe him, then when he says do it, why are we saying, oh, you don't really mean that, God? Because let God be true and every man a liar. Isn't that the same guy that some folks try to credit and say he tells you it was all done away with? All right, a couple of more comments on this. And I'm looking at a piece. This time it's a piece from a rabbi, Ari Khan, about the Atzitzel. And he points out, basically, what we're talking about here in Leviticus chapter 16 is this choice of good versus evil. And that's part of the reason why I started with the news tonight. I think the contrast between good and evil has never been more clear. The contrast between who is lying and who is telling the truth. Whose God is real, right? If God be God, serve him, said Elijah. If Baal be God, serve him. Choose. Choose this day whom you will serve. Joshua, same question, gave his answer. As for me and my house, we will serve Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. And to that, Yeshua added a poignant suffix, and him alone. Because we're at a place, folks, where you cannot serve two masters, and that ought to be increasingly clear. So, think about the twos that appear in this. We got the two goats, and because it starts the chapter by telling us Akremot, after the death of the two sons of Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, do we learn anything from their death? Well, they offered strange fire. There's no doubt these were zealous guys. They were sharp fellas. They went in there with the best of intentions, and it ended up costing them their lives. Both of them, in this case. And Rabbi Khan points out that there is this line, whether we like it or not, between the service of Elohim and self-styled service. Oh, we think God ought to like it this way. See, we're going to call this golden calf. We're going to actually name it Yahuwah. That was Aaron's excuse. We'll just say this is tomorrow will be a feast to Yahuwah. We're just going to use this golden calf to do it. He'll love it. I know he didn't. But the difference between the real service, the way he specifies it, and the self-styled service that got Nadab and Abihu killed is literally the difference between life and death. What does it tell us all through the first part of this chapter? Do these things, do them the right way so that Aaron dies not. And here's the commentary that I think really kind of begins to help us put some of this stuff in perspective as we look at this time of the year. There are a lot of things. Oops. It's Pal. Pal Talk. Okay, we got the ones back again. You may have some ones when you're hearing me. Okay, good. Don't know what happened, but it does. It's Pal Talk. Anyway, essentially there have been people that suggested that the problem that Nadab and Abihu had was their unbridled passion for Elohim. We're so excited, we're just going to do it. We may not be doing it exactly the way he likes, but hey, he knows our hearts. We've heard that before. Didn't work out so well for them. They had a sense of joy and ecstasy. So they approached Elohim in an improper manner, and as a result, they died. Now, here's the paragraph that I like. I'm just going to read what he says here. The seriousness and somberness of Yom Kippur stands in stark contrast. The specifications, ancient and today, afflict your souls. Do no work whatsoever. Set this day apart. It is a day of true, separate holiness, if you will, set apart to him. The message is clear. The pitfall of religious experience born of ecstasy is trying to create a relationship which is not wanted by God. You want to go to him? Go to him the way he asks, not the way you in your wisdom think he ought to want it, whether he says so or whether he says not. Hey, it's about who is to be master, that is all. To act out of ecstasy alone, he continues, is to make the experience subjective and ultimately selfish. the one that is desired by the worshiper, but not by the object of worship. Yod Heh Vav Heh. The end result may just mean that the worshiper is crossing that line between creating a god in his own image instead of manifesting the image of Elohim within himself. Now, that doesn't mean they're saying that you can't have a sincere act of worship that comes out of an ecstatic understanding, you know, the pinnacle of religious zeal. We all would like a joyful relationship with Elohim, but such a relationship needs to be developed from a desire to please Him first in the manner that He has taught us He wants to be pleased. I mean, if you think about it, ultimately, in a sexual relationship between man and wife, oh, you ought to like this. Well, I don't. It's a similar concept. I don't. Who is to be master? If he is to be the bridegroom, if he is to be the king, if he is to be the master, if he is to be the husband, and he is, and he has written for us his instruction, and he has, and he says, do these things. This is a Sabbath of solemn rest unto you. You shall afflict your souls. It is a statute forever. Why don't we simply do that? Ultimately, and I like this conclusion, this is the balance between this idea of the love of God and the fear of God that we see taught all the time. Okay, let's begin to wrap it up, and I'll talk a little bit more about the twin goats. I think this is an interesting set of observations here, and I know some of you've probably heard a bit of this. But as we think about Yom Kippur, and by the way, again, we've got a period of time for afflicting our souls. If that means to you, and I'll tell you what I intend to do, you do not have to do the same. I intend to refrain, to fast from both food and water. And believe me, you know, the 24-hour food fast is no big deal. That's a piece of cake. 24-hour water fast tends to be a little bit more difficult. I'm a water drinker. At the end of about 20 hours, I'm starting to think, I'd really love a glass of water. To my mind, again, this is a personal understanding. When I read that word, anah, afflict your soul, if I want to truly be afflicted in a way that I think is being in obedience, again, you don't have to believe the same thing. That's okay. But to my mind, it means refrain from water. That way I know that my soul is being afflicted, and I can really focus on what it is that it would seem like he wants me to focus on that day. Another aspect... if you ask most of the rabbinic teachings, they will tell you, and I have a good friend who is a high-ranking rabbi, who is, he's a young man at heart, but he's an older man physically, and he's had some medical issues, and he said, you know, it hurts me nowadays, but my doctor's telling me that I shouldn't be doing that water fast, and I might not even should be doing certain other kinds of fast, so I'm going to afflict my soul in a different way. Just because the idea is still, ultimately, remember, Torah is about choosing life. Ultimately, we choose life. So keep all of those things in mind and perspective. And if you have some doubts about what that word anah means, afflict your nefesh, pray about it. And then try to walk in obedience to what the answer is. All right, back to the two goats. Contrast begins this story. If the actions of Nadab and Abihu, the central worship of the day involved two goats. One is offered in the sanctuary, the other is shalacht, sent into the desert. And that, some have said, looks like a pretty obvious parallel to two different kinds of worship. The kind of worship that is in the sanctuary for God, and the other kind that obviously has no place in the sanctuary. It's the worship of the world. Might even be the kind that has no place among the living at all. The kind that belongs in a place of desolation. Draw your own parallels, but as I was reading that, I'm thinking, Ishtar Day, Mithra's birthday, any number of pagan things that we've taken and mixed in and said, oh, this is Christianity. God will love it, even if he doesn't say so. Even if he says the exact opposite, oh, he's got to love this. We're doing it for you. It just may be, folks, that some of the kinds of worship, in other words, that he calls pagan and says, have no place in my house, he means it. And maybe the symbolism of the two goats hits a little bit closer to home than some of the church would like. As a matter of fact, if I'm looking for a reason why they got rid of all that Jewish stuff, wasn't Jewish. It was the stuff that Yod Heh Vav Heh says to do. But they got rid of all of it, perhaps because it bothered him a little bit. He didn't seem to like the kinds of things that they were telling him he ought to. And hey, we're rewriting this stuff. They did. Okay, the service, though, the idea of the two goats does seem a bit bizarre. Why would we take a goat, select it, simply to reject it, and then shalak it, send it away? The instruction seems to teach us about a stark difference between the service to God which is accepted and which he loves, as opposed to the scapegoat, which represents that which is rejected by him. But there's more to it still. Now, he points out that the sages have said that those two goats on Yom Kippur should be identical in appearance, in size, and in value. They're to be chosen together. In other words, they're to look like twins. We're going to pick one by lot, but that seems strange. Why do they need to be identical, especially when they're going to be treated so differently? And maybe therein lies a lot of the instruction on the day. Because if you go back and see other places where you see twins in Scripture, but it turns out that they're not really that similar at all, at least not on the inside, that's a familiar theme in Torah. The most obvious example are the twins Jacob and Esau. Yaakov I have loved, Esau I have hated, is one of the verses that kind of comes to mind too. They were opposites, at least in some respects. One good, the other evil, says this piece. Esau, a man of the fields. Yaakov, different. No one could ever confuse them. But the story goes, at least the Midrash says, up until they were in their early teens, they were hard to tell apart. Now, whether that's true or not, Scripture doesn't give us enough information. It certainly does tell us that later on, Esau was hairy, and his name, Edom, and other things like that get associated with this idea of red. But at least for a while, they evidently dressed like the other. They walk alike, they talk alike. Oh, is it the Patty Duke show? At times they even talk alike. One spoke like the other. Did the divine plan require twins? Evidently. I even heard an interesting conjecture earlier this week. I'll just throw it out because it struck me as something that I intend to think about and pray about some more. And that is that just maybe there was a surface twinning that happened, but let's just say at some level, obviously they're different people, there was a difference in their DNA. Was the difference deeper rooted than that? In other words, was there something even nefarious going on in a sense of the adversary? I don't know. It's an interesting speculation. I'm not going to draw conclusions, but as we look at what's going on in the world today, I'll admit, it kind of begins to resonate home too. In any case, what the sages have said, and this certainly makes sense to me, when things look alike from the exterior point of view, it's a sign that we need to look deeper, look within, look at the essence in order to have discernment, discern the difference. Indeed, that's what you see with Jacob and Esau. They may have looked alike on the surface. Yaakov, with a little bit of fooling, was able to fool his dad. But their essence is different, internally, spiritually, if you will. They're different. So the question, I guess, that these people want to draw the conclusion from is, are we sometimes dressing ourselves up and keeping our Esau spirit on the inside instead of behaving like the Israel that we're supposed to be? Interestingly enough, at this time when this fooling is getting ready to happen, Rebekah, Yaakov's mom, tells him, "Go now to the herd and bring me two good goats." It's Genesis 27:9. Why are they both called good goats? They're good for lots of reasons. All right, that brings us to this final point, I guess. We've talked about the symbolism. We've got two goats. One of them is going to be sent away. They look identical. Maybe, indeed, they are, for all purposes, identical. And yet there's going to be a difference made here. The difference may be, just be as simple as the lot fell on one of them. And maybe that's an indication, the goat says to the other goat, "Hey, there but for the grace of God go I," right? I could have been the one that got whacked. Instead, I get to go into the wilderness, or vice versa. They look the same. They're not. So what does the word atzatzel mean? The one that's going to be sent into the wilderness is called the goat for atzatzel. Now, there is a famous rabbi that gets the credit for this. I've seen this a number of times over the years. And, you know, you see it enough time, you start to think, well, maybe it begins to make sense. Anyway, oftentimes, within the Hebrew language, people will take an acronym of a famous phrase. Perhaps the most famous is the one that was written by Pilate on the inscription that was put under Yeshua on the tree. And it goes something like, Yehoshua HaNatzri V'melech HaYehudim. And the rabbis were upset. Well, if you take the first letters of that, it spells Yod Hey Vav Hey. No wonder they were upset. Turns out that what this famous rabbi Menachem Azariah DeFano said, the name Atzitzel is an acronym for the Hebrew phrase that says Ze Leumat Ze Asa Elohim. God, Elohim, has made one as well as the other. He made them both. Now, where does that line come from? It comes from Solomon, Ecclesiastes, verse 7:14. And I do think this is a beautiful verse. It says this, in the day of prosperity, be joyful. In the day of adversity, consider. God has made one as well as the other. When I read that line tonight, literally just a few hours ago, this afternoon, I guess, as when I decided, I got to talk about this tonight. That's why I'm going to put the news first. Because it fits today. In the day of prosperity, be joyful. In the day of adversity, and it's coming, folks, consider. God has made one as well as the other. He has made both of those goats, the lot, selected which one was his and which one goes into the wilderness. Hey, are we his? And do we get to go into the wilderness? Do we make it through this alive? He knows. As of yet, we don't. I guess my take on that score is walk in obedience, do the best we can, and leave the results up to him. God has made one as well as the other. In the day of prosperity, I'll say it again, be joyful. In the day of adversity, consider. Ze leumat ze asa Elohim. He has made them both. He's made one as well as the other. This contrast between good and evil, the recognition that both, even those things that we would not call good, were still made by him, right? The adversary, is he not a creation of the Almighty? He's a created being. The Midrash has said that, you know, the same thing is true. Elohim made both Yaakov and Esau. Don't forget that. So understand. Maybe we don't have a complete understanding even of what we're supposed to do and how we're supposed to put all this together on Yom Kippur. I think as much as anything, to my mind, that is part of the beauty of a day that is, admittedly, a bit difficult. The fasting to afflict your spirit, your soul, nefesh, is a difficult thing to do. However, there is a blessing. I haven't said this tonight. I'll say it kind of as we wrap up. I have been taught when I was first looking at this years ago. Hey, think of the Day of Atonement a little bit like the performance appraisal. You know, if you were working at I worked at IBM for years, and you had your annual performance appraisal. Gonna go sit in front of the manager. What'd you get right? What'd you get wrong? You did really good here. I'm giving you a one. Good job for that. This, not so good, though. Maybe a 3. Do better next time. We are literally looking at the same thing, in a way, when it comes to Yom Kippur. Hey, Father, how'd I do? What do I need to work on? What can I do better on? Out in the wilderness? It's a time to get on our face before Him. It's a time to atone, to teshuvah first, and to allow the covering that he has for us. And yeah, there's a lot of things that he has done for us. Praise Yah for that. But we're told to do this every year. We're told that, if we don't do this, we can be cut off. I don't want to be cut off. I especially don't want to be cut off at times like this. I don't want my loved ones to be cut off either. We pray every week for our families, and I have family members, as I'm sure most of you do, that are not walking in obedience. I pray for them regardless. I don't want them to die. I especially don't want them to die in a really permanent sense. I don't want them to die in a place of rebellion to Yah. Do I know exactly what that means? No. I just know that I pray that He will give them covering. And I know that it is a blessing for them if there would be chastening and that they would repent. Teshuvah, turn back around and seek His covering, His atonement, especially at this particular time of the year. So may it be true for all of us. And if you've never done it before, if you've got loved ones, family, that have never done it before, take a look at the news. Show them. Take them to Leviticus chapter 23, those few verses, 26 through 30-ish. Take them to Leviticus chapter 16. Point out to them, He does not say, this was done away with ever. This is something we're still supposed to do. It is a blessing. And if we'll do it honestly and to come before Him in the way that He says He wants us to, and He's the boss, then we can achieve that atonement. And we'll learn something too. I guarantee you, having done it year after year at this point, we will learn something. There is a blessing that comes from obedience. That much we absolutely positively know because His Word promises that too. So, may your fast go easy. May you be blessed. And may we all have eyes to see and ears to hear, and at this particular time of year especially. May we see the things that He has for us. May we understand the blessings of His Torah, and may we walk in obedience, and may we be counted worthy to escape these things that we can now so clearly see coming. Praise Yah. All right, got a question from Tom. Let's see. Have you ever considered a possible relationship with how the Hebrews bore their iniquity in the wilderness and the hairy goat to Azazel? It's a good question. I don't know if I can give you an answer to it other than to say, yeah, the more you look at these parallels and the more you look at these things, hey, we can't do the two goats today, right? Don't have the sanctuary. Why do we bother with studying this? You know, can't make those burned offerings. Hey, we can still learn something from the imagery, from the pictures, from the history, from the prophecies. And given that we know that there are still prophetic things that are going to play out, it's all the more important that we read and understand and do the things that He says to do.